ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Every year, there are important new medical discoveries that help people live longer and more productive lives. One of the big reasons is the constant development of new drugs to treat or help prevent diseases. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet two scientists deeply involved in the discovery of new pharmaceuticals right here in Milwaukee. Jim Cook is one of UWM's distinguished professors in chemistry and biochemistry. And Doug Stafford is director of the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery, headquartered at UWM. Both of these men have spent their careers searching for new ways of using chemistry to make life better. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you in the studio, Jim.
Thank you.
And Jim, let's begin with you. You hold patents or patent applications on 47 compounds that are tied to moving into a new drug, a new pharmaceutical. Let's talk about that path. You really are a detective, aren't you?
Absolutely. I think we've been lucky, but anybody who's lucky has to do a lot of experiments. So we were interested in the Valium area a long time ago because we wanted tranquilizers that didn't have side effects. And so we began to try to make compounds that bound to the Valium receptors in the brain. And it turns out as we worked longer and longer, people began to find other things, that there were actually six receptor subtypes. And so what we realized is that if you can get a compound that binds to just one receptor subtype, you're going to really drastically reduce the chance of having side effects. And it develops really strangely over a period of time where molecular biologists and pharmacologists were making new discoveries. At the same time, we were making compounds that bound to those subtypes. And so in the beginning, when we began to publish papers, there were a lot of people all over the world saying, you know, Jim, we really would like to have this alpha-5 Valium subtype because it doesn't have sedation, but it enhances memory. And so we followed that. We followed this for a long time, probably really at maximum level for 20 years. So we really know a lot about these different subtypes. And I'll give you a couple examples. One of which we licensed to Bristol-Myers Squibb years ago for anxiety. Of the six subtypes that are in the brain that bind or can bind Valium, one of them causes almost all the side effects. People call it the alpha-1 subtype just to make things easy. But that one causes sedation, ataxia, amnesia, most of the addiction, and also tolerance to the effects of benzodiazepines. So we licensed that compound to Bristol-Myers Squibb, and they took it all the way to phase one. And in phase one, it lasted all the way through in humans, but it didn't have enough efficacy to go into market because you would have had to take three pills a day. It had no side effects like Valium had, so we basically succeeded in what we wanted to do. But we just needed a compound that was more potent. And so it was metabolized in humans too rapidly. So we kept working and working on this, and now we have some compounds that we've basically, a startup company has already licensed them from us. It's called NeuroCycle Therapeutics, and they are looking at trying to license these compounds or try to get them in the clinic for not only anxiety, but also epilepsy, as well as neuropathic pain, so diabetic neuropathy, back pain, cancer pain. And these are not like opioids. They don't have tolerance like opioids. They don't have addiction like opioids. And in fact, we've just shown that if you gave these compounds to animals, to basically rats, they don't develop any addiction to these drugs at all, to this new drug.
Are you ever surprised at where the path may take you in terms of how these compounds might end up helping address an issue that you never even considered at the beginning of research?
That's a great question. I mean, this is really important in terms of Doug Stafford, because we made a series of compounds years ago that bound to the alpha-4 subtype. So I told you there were six subtypes. It turned bound to the alpha 4, and another series of bound to alpha 5. Nobody was interested. They sat in my sample boxes. We kept them. And all at once, an anesthesiologist from Columbia University emailed me and says, Jim, can we use your compounds? We've just discovered these in the lung. And if they're in the lung, they're going to be active in relaxing bronchoconstriction. And we think they're going to be important for asthma. And so we've done this. And maybe Doug can talk about it because he's the real expert on asthma.
Well, let's bring Doug into the conversation, leading this Institute for Drug Discovery. Doug, at the just before we began taping, you said, you know, it is kind of interesting. A lot of people say, what are universities doing that we thought a drug company was going to be doing? And here Jim is making these discoveries that do connect to the business.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's an interesting evolution of the business of drug development. Historically, pharmaceutical companies are fully integrated firms that have basic research scientists like what we do. But then they have all of the next steps in the process, from taking a basic discovery to showing that it's really effective in animal models, ultimately getting into human clinical trials, the various phases of human testing that would lead to FDA approval and the marketing of a drug. So that fully integrated model has been in existence for many years. But there's been a transition over the last 20 years or so where much of the front-end innovation, where you have the blackboard where scientists like Jim and others draw out some schemes, really innovative things, and universities are really pretty good at doing that. And so there's really been a little bit of a separation of where innovation occurs and where much of the downstream development occurs that need big infrastructure, big multinational organizations to do these trials, where innovation is now done on campuses like in our institute, where you have small groups, very innovative scientists whose primary mission is to create new knowledge. That's what we do on a campus. We create new knowledge. Well, that knowledge is very much directed to a need for a new drug. But we're doing what we do really well. We embrace new ideas, maybe some types of technologies that a large firm wouldn't invest in because it's maybe too risky. But we do that, and we do it well. And not only are we developing new knowledge, we're using that as a platform to train the next generation of scientists. And so we fulfill really our main missions then, don't we? So we create knowledge, we train new students, and then we apply that to unmet medical needs that we really believe are going to improve healthcare over the long term.
When the two of you are doing research on these compounds that might lead to a new drug, does it start with you thinking, this there's a need out there and I wonder if this would work? Or do the pharmaceutical companies come to you and say, Jim, Doug, we've got a problem. Can you help us?
You know, usually for me, Doug now will find new targets for my work that I'd never thought of. I mean, he's really an immunologist by training who knows chemistry as well. But he will come to me and say, Jim, we have these compounds for neuropathic pain. I bet they're involved in the immune response in neuropathic pain as well. So I get a lot of new ideas from Doug now. All right. But I get a lot of ideas from collaborators. So, what we want to do normally is if we get a subtype selective ligand, we want to publish it as soon as possible. And we have people around the world who will write us and say, you know, Jim, we'd like to collaborate. Can we get this compound in our hands? I'll give you an example. We were making compounds related to Valium, and we published a paper which showed we had a compound that wasn't sedating. I get an email from a young doctor at Harvard at that time, and she says, we're studying pediatric neuroblastoma, and those alpha 5 subtypes that your ligands bind to are really upregulated on pediatric neuroblastoma, and there's nothing to treat that in young children. This is really difficult to treat. It's very aggressive. So we got involved in this cancer program with her, and now we find out the compounds that we probably wouldn't even have made are really active, and they're active against 3 or 4 different kinds of cancers. And it's because that subtype is upregulated on all these tumors. So that means we can hit that subtype without hitting other subtypes and other receptors in your body and mine that we wouldn't want to hit, all right? And so that just came out of nowhere. It's like Christmas, all right? And you know, you hear the word publish or perish. My students and I are dying to publish. okay? My graduate students are counting the papers when they get them, okay? And we are really excited if somebody around the world or across the ocean can use our work. I mean, because they can push it forward sometimes if we can't. So we're really involved in probably, I bet, 8 different diseases, including some that are not central nervous system. Some, like we're looking for cures to treat MRSA infections. So those are the ones that kill people in the hospital, and eventually they can lead to this drug-resistant infections. And so we have compounds that are really good, that are really easy to make. The question is, will we be able to push them far enough ahead to get them in the clinic? And that's going to take NIH money. It's going to take some investment. It'll take hard work, although we have really good leads already.
Jim, you mentioned the clinic. Let's talk about where UWM finishes its work and then somebody else picks it up, because we don't do clinical testing at the university on humans, do we?
No, we don't. We don't have a medical school, but as you mentioned, we do collaborate extensively with medical centers all over the world. And within those medical centers, specifically with medical specialists that are really renowned in the disease area of interest to us, whether it's neuroscience or asthma or whatever, it might be infectious disease. And so we have those linkages set up very early in the research that when it comes time where a molecule has been perfected, where it looks like a drug that could be used, where all the preliminary studies have been done, then it's pretty a ready pathway to move forward. There's certainly an FDA process involved. But for us to do clinical trials, as Jim mentioned, we really need to partner. And those partnerships could be pharmaceutical companies, kind of as we were talking about before, when it comes time, when a molecule is perfected, they'd be more than happy to take it on. Our research foundation, UWM Research Foundation, handles patenting of the inventions that come from our research. And they're ultimately responsible for making the arrangements with pharmaceutical firms to be able to use our technology to move these things forward. So it's really to add what Jim was talking about, we don't do this work in isolation. The work is done typically in interdisciplinary teams of scientists. You might think of the lone scientist with the white coat in the laboratory working all night long, you know, by himself or herself coming up with the invention.
Waiting for a eureka moment.
And we do have those, but normally they're done in teams. This work is very complicated, and no one scientific specialist or specialty can understand all of the questions and how to answer them. And so, for example, in one of our drug discovery programs, we might have medicinal chemists, which are organic chemists. We may have analytical chemists, drug development chemists, biology, a whole range of biologists, and people who understand the medical side of it. So these teams come together, and I think that's really part of the fun of what we do when we have teams of people with all different perspectives coming together, sharing those ideas, and seeing how that advances the technology in ways that no one of us could possibly do.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. We're talking chemistry and biochemistry and the role that the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays in discovering new drugs that truly can improve our life. In the studio with us, Jim Cook, UWM's Distinguished Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry, and Doug Stafford, who directs UWM's Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery. Jim, let's go back a little bit in your career. How did you first get interested in this search for new drugs?
It was probably by accident. I grew up loving to make molecules. I love to make organic molecules. It's like playing with Tinker Toys, only you're using live atoms. And so I was doing organic chemistry, and we actually discovered by accident some compounds that enhanced memory. And when you began to look at the mechanism, it was this benzodiazepine valium receptor idea. And these didn't do what normally those valium would do, where it relaxes neurotransmission. These excited neurotransmission. And so they enhanced memory. And so that's really, once we did that, then we got collaborators who were pharmacologists who were really, really smart. And we could learn as much from them as they could from us. And then we just carried it on. And we carried it on. And, you know, some of these things have worked out fairly well. I mean, we co-founded Promentis Pharmaceutical with David Baker at Marquette. Now, it was really David's idea, and he had to convince me to make the molecules. But once he did, I realized how great this idea was. And that startup company is still going, and they're trying to license a compound this summer for an IND. I mean, they think they have finally gotten enough preclinical work to do this. And that was fun because David's at Marquette, and he's right here, okay? We've collaborated a lot with people at the Medical College of Wisconsin on bladder pain. Turns out if you have trouble with your bladder when you're younger – and you have a lot of inflammation. When you get older, somehow the neurons just keep telling you that you have pain in your bladder, and it's very painful. So there's Jyoti Sengupta at the medical college that we've been collaborating with to try to find some way to treat bladder pain. But again, it came from these same benzodiazepine valium receptors, but nobody realized they were in the bladder. It turns out there are a lot of places that we don't know where they were, and now we do. And that's really a great advantage for us because we've been doing this so long. We don't need computer models anymore. We have enough of those. We just need to make the molecules and have them screened.
And there's an endless variety or number
absolutely.
Of molecules and compounds you can create.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. What you have to do is be careful not to be making too many. And I think that's where computer modeling comes in. So people always talk about how great computer modeling is. So you model a receptor. For us, the computer modeling is great because it tells us which 1,000 compounds not to make. Which 1,000 compounds are not going to bind to this receptor. And that's a great advantage because you just don't waste your time. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, we'll make a series of compounds. One will be active. The other 30 might not. That's just the way it is.
Don't you get discouraged, though?
No. Okay. If you have a compound that looks really good and all of a sudden somebody tells you it puts everybody to sleep, you do get discouraged for a day or so, okay? But then you go right back to the ground zero and start working on this thing again. So I think you're problem solving all the time, Tom. So that's really a lot of the fun of it. It's a lot of the fun for my graduate students and postdocs. I mean, these kids are really good and they want to solve problems. And that this is a case where they can solve problems where they might actually help somebody in terms of treating a disease.
Did you have a chemistry kit when you were growing up?
I probably did. But the worst thing I did was probably make rocket engines. We made rocket engines, all right, and in a little hut, okay, where if we had an explosion, it would have not expanded anywhere. And that was probably the most significant thing I did. But they worked well.
The reason I ask is because today in a world where STEM is celebrated so much and we talk about getting kids interested in science and knowing that there are these enormous opportunities ahead of them, I'm always curious about where that seed got planted, you know?
I think for me, I had a really good chemistry teacher in high school, and it's so critical. It turns out, though, that he was only really good for about the top 10% of the class. I think the rest of the class couldn't keep up, which was really too bad because he was a serious teacher, very serious. But he was really good, and he got all of us who cared about science interested in chemistry and also physics as well. And then I was lucky enough that I had a neighbor who had actually started a chemical plant. So in high school, I worked after school in a chemical plant from about age 15 on. Oh, it was fun. I mean, you make molecules and then all at once you see a tank car going down the track with your compound in it. I mean, that makes a big impression on a 15 to 17-year-old kid, I'll tell you. And so that really helped me a lot too. I had good mentors. I've always had good mentors. I learned a lot from them, and I always also knew something Doug knows, that there are people that are older than we are, that are a lot wiser than we are, and we can learn a lot from them.
Amen, amen. How about you, Doug? How did you start your path?
Yeah, I've always been interested in animals. I grew up on a little farm and was always interested in animals and, you know, went to school and got a degree in biology and just wanted to keep going and ultimately got a PhD in immunology, which is quite different skill than many of my colleagues. But I got into industry right away and understood that it's one thing to have a discovery. It's quite another thing to take that discovery and make it available for patients. There's a lot of process involved. And so I got interested in that whole translational area of science and being able to take a basic discovery like what we do at UWM and move it forward. And you know, part of what has always been really gratifying to me is to see a product actually on a shelf or being prescribed to a person or treating a disease, and understanding that that's a skill set that not everybody has, but that's something that's really important. And I think that's really part of the rationale of the Institute, or kind of what I see my role there is to complement the scientists who are doing the basic discovery and to help them be successful by providing the tools for the research and in some way the funding for the research and understanding how the relationships are established with pharmaceutical companies to move the inventions forward. Because I think it would be a real tragedy if we discover something great and it doesn't make it to a patient. And we see that the work that we're doing really is a solution to many problems in healthcare. And in order to get there, to solve a problem for a patient, we really have to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And so, you know, I think part of my role and others around us are really focused on doing that.
Let's talk about your students. Jim, you've probably had hundreds of thousands of students over the years. And you're still a young man.
Oh, no. But I've probably had maybe 60 to 80 graduate students, master's and PhD students. I've taught a lot of undergraduates, of course, but they're not in the lab, except once in a while we get an undergraduate who wants to do undergraduate research, and they do very well. I have really good students. And what happens is you just have the right combination. And it's cyclical. If I have two or three people that help people integrate and talk to each other, the group does so well, it's just amazing. And that's what I have right now. And I've been lucky enough in my whole career for a long time at UWM to have that type of group all the time. I didn't go through the cycle where you go down in the wave, okay? I always was at the top because the students were really good. Now, that doesn't mean every student was really good. That means the key nucleus of those students were really good, they worked really hard, and then they really trained everybody else. And then the new group would take over, and then they would be the stars, a little like a baseball team. You can hit a home run, you're a star for one day, but what we want to know what you're going to do the next three or four days as well.
So what's the career path for these students?
So there are various career paths now. I mean, in the years ago, they just used to work solely in pharmaceutical companies. But since they're chemists and they can make molecules, I mean, they can make anything. So they can work in a paint company. They can work in a polymer company. Anything that needs to make new materials. Now, I have one student in the DEA, a PhD student working in the Department of Justice, another one working for the FDA. And then so there are a lot of jobs, for instance, the EPA and the CDC, where they need chemists. And so some of these students may end up working there. It depends on what their goal is. Now, when they first come to me, they want to work in a pharmaceutical company because they want to do chemistry. And just like Doug said, they want to do something important. They want to save the world. Now, they soon learn it's a lot more difficult to save the world than they thought when they came in the lab. But at least we're on the right track. And I think they're excited about that.
Doug, the Drug Discovery Institute at UWM, what role has that played in helping advance the discovery, literally the discovery, of new ways of healing people and preventing disease?
I think from several different perspectives. I think when I first started here 6 years ago, there was terrific science, but there were some limitations on how far we could take that science and development, principally because of the tools that are necessary. And so one of our early objectives was to make sure that the scientists, the research faculty, and all the students doing the work could take their molecules, do the type of analysis to really prove that they can do what we hope they could do. And so we spent a lot of time and we're fortunate to receive some very significant state financing and some private sector financing to put together a world-class analytical chemistry facility, which definitely has been a factor in us to be able to move the science forward.
The Kenwood Integrated Research.
Yeah, absolutely. Complex. And the laboratories we have in there. And so these facilities are as fine as exists anywhere at a university. And those are used by the faculty members and the students on a daily basis. And so it's the proof of concept that we can now do that. I think the Institute has had a pretty big role in. We've been able to secure federal financing as well as some of the private financing. And also, too, is that we think more about how the technologies can be used across our traditional areas of thinking. And Jim had mentioned that we have a significant asthma program. And the Institute was really instrumental in providing the funding for that program, we're well on our way to development of an oral asthma drug that would replace the typical inhaler medications that we all know of.
That would be an amazing breakthrough.
It really is. And not only is there a new chemical entity, a new compound in our drug, but also just the ease of taking the drug makes it more usable by the patient, compliant, what we call drug compliance is better, so that it's overall a better therapy. And so this is a significant program for us. And I think what the Institute has been involved in is putting the teams together and providing the funding and understanding what the critical design features would be for a drug like that. So that's a major project for us, and we're pretty proud that the Institute has had a big role in that.
Just a couple minutes left. Jim, what's the future? What's next on your plate after holding and all of these discoveries?
I think for us, persistence is one major thing, because if we want to get drugs in the clinic, we're going to have to be persistent. And so we have the ones we think that should be pushed. One of the things we'll have to do is try to find enough capital. We've had NIH funding to make all the discoveries. The question is, will we be able to get enough funding to push it into phase one and then license it to a major pharmaceutical company? And part of that's startup companies. So we have one startup that just started up that's licensing our compounds. And then there may be, we're hoping for other ones, especially in the asthma area. And we have some drugs for Tourette syndrome as well as major depression as well. I mean, they're active in models. We'll have to see how far that goes. So we still have a lot of work to do.
Easy to get up in the morning and come to work.
Oh, absolutely.
When you see what's in front of you.
Absolutely. Even to work on the weekends, it's easy.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing your stories. Congratulations on the great progress that you've made already. And we're going to have you back on as we see how these clinical trials go and see whether or not more of our listeners may one day be using the drugs that are currently just on the cusp of development.
That'd be great to be here again. Great. Thank you.
Jim Cook, UWM's Distinguished Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry, and Doug Stafford, who directs the Milwaukee Institute for Drug Discovery at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We will see you next week as we learn more about the amazing people and wonderful discoveries that take place every day at Wisconsin's second largest university. Take care, everybody. See you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.